This is Betty Turnell speaking for the Decatur Public Library, and our guest today is Mr. Wilfred W. Miller, known to his friends as Will Miller. Mr. Miller is the narrator and Betty Turnell is the interviewer. And we are in the library recording at the request of the Decatur Public Library on June 28, 1985. Well, Mr. Miller, you recently retired after a long career with the post office here at Decatur. Could you tell us about your work there, how you got started, and something about your early jobs there?
I'd be happy to. I started, of course, in 1935, October the 1st. I was going to University of Illinois at that time, and the examination came open. I had no idea that I would actually go to work there, but I thought since the examination was there, I'd take it just to see how I did. There were over 300 people at that time that took the examination. I was fortunate enough to get a fairly decent grade, so I was offered a job. And I took the job and started working there October the 1st of 35 in the old post office. Many people don't remember where that was, but it was located where the YWCA is. Well, the YWCA annex is now. It was on the corner of Main and El Dorado. That old post office was built in the Carnegie style of architecture, and directly across the street was our Decatur Public Library at that time, also in the same style of architecture. Perhaps if those were still here, they probably would be part of the Historical Society preservation. But I worked there 1 month. The new post office was in the process of being built. So I worked at the old post office 1 month, and then we moved into the new post office. I started as a substitute distribution clerk, a job, and that became a regular clerk about March the 1st of the next year. I worked as a distribution clerk then for about 7 years. At that time, World War II came along. And of course I was in that. Stayed most of the time in New York City working in the postal battalion there. Came back and became a supervisor, the bottom rung of the supervisory ladder, which at that time was called clerk in charge. It was clerk in charge in the office of superintendent of mails. From there I was promoted to station examiner, which involves auditing the financial accounts of the different window clerks and substations. Then at that time, the Army came out with what they call an affiliation program. They would go to a laundry and say, if you will organize a quartermaster corps laundry unit in the reserves and meet regularly, that's what we'd like for you to do. Well, I came to the Postal Service and said, will you organize an Army postal unit in the reserves? So our postmaster at that time was very much interested in that. His name was Jim Allen, and he shortly retired after that, and Richard Ellison became the postmaster, and he was also interested in it. So I became the commanding officer of a 15-man Army postal unit. And we were meeting at the Signal Depot about once every 2 weeks. And we went to summer camp for 2 weeks, and we trained in both the Army postal work and Army training itself. We thought we had a pretty good deal. And we were sure that we would be the last ones that would ever be called to active duty. We didn't even think about that. Well, it turns out we were the first ones to be called out of the Decatur area. We were activated in 1950 for the Korean conflict. We went to Fort Bragg, North Carolina, and we stayed there for about 2 years, at least I did, and ran the post offices down there on the Army base. Many of my men, of course, went overseas. I stayed there and kept new people coming in and still operate the thing. Then came back, and when I came back, I was promoted to superintendent of the window service, the main post office, and then we built the Brentwood station and opened it in 1963. And I was the first superintendent of the Brentwood station at that time. Stayed there until 68, came back downtown as assistant superintendent of mails, and then became superintendent of mails, assistant postmaster. And originally that's as high as I thought I could ever go, because when I started in the Postal Service, all postmasters were political appointments. I wasn't a politician, so I knew that the highest I could get would be assistant postmaster. That changed with the Reorganization Act in 1971, and now it would be a detriment to anybody aspiring to become a postmaster if they tried to use political influence. So my ambitions rose a little higher, and I decided, well, if I'm assistant postmaster, maybe someday I can get the top job in Decatur. And fortunately that came about when Chan Glosser retired. And so I was appointed postmaster in 1977, February. It was kind of a family joke. I have two daughters who I'm very proud of, and it was a family joke. I used to kid them. I worked 41 years and then shot right to the top. That's how long it took me to become postmaster. I stayed there, of course, until this last April, and retired after 49 years and 7 months. I figured that was about long enough to work. I wanted to get out while I was still in good health and enjoy retirement, which certainly is not too hard to do. So it's been a very rewarding career, and I've enjoyed it. People ask me, do you miss it? And I do not miss the work or the pressures that go along with the job. I was ready to give that up, but I certainly do miss the people, because I had an excellent staff of supervisors and a very high quality of employee that worked in the post office. And I'm proud to count so many of them as friends, not just as employees. And it was a very rewarding career. I enjoyed it very much.
Well, that was a wonderful overview of the long career, Mr. Miller. But it struck me when you mentioned 1935, that must have been in the depths of the Depression, or very near. I'm sure you must have been affected by the Depression, and as everyone else was. Would you mind telling us your salary then?
Yes, it's kind of surprising, I suppose, to a lot of people, but I began work for 65 cents an hour, which was pretty good in those days. I have a check. The payroll used to be signed by the postmaster here locally. Of course, now it's all electronically done through the data centers and computers and all of that. But the postmaster used to sign the checks locally, and the payroll was made locally. And of course, the canceled checks were stored. Well, about a year or two ago, we were cleaning out some of the old records in one of our storage rooms and ran across some of these old canceled checks, which are long served their useful period. I looked through there and found one of my first checks. It was for 2 weeks, actually a little more than 2 weeks. We were paid twice a month, and full-time work now, and for 2 weeks salary, or a little more than 2 weeks salary, it was $76.34. That was the take-home pay. But shortly after I went to work, in about a year, I got married. My wife was also working, and I was making somewhere around $2,100 a year, and she was making about $1,800. So between us, we were making about $4,000 a year. And we, very comfortably, you know, it was very nice.
Could you live on your first salary? I mean, that was before you were married, but mm-hmm. I mean, to show how the salary was relative.
Oh, certainly. Yes, that was not starvation wages.
No.
Even 65 cents an hour was not starvation wages because all the other prices were relative to that.
You could get a dinner for 50 cents.
Well, exactly. I remember definitely going over to Springfield a number of times to a place that used to be called the Pillsbury Mill. And they had a list of entrees, maybe 8 or 10 of them, all for 55 cents. Mm-hmm. And that included everything. So it's kind of unbelievable.
Yes, it is. Well, now you mentioned your work with the Army.
Mm-hmm.
This was not a part of your regular post office job when you organized the Postal Service for the Armed Service.
No, it was recommended and approved by the Postal Service, but we did the organizing and we met once every 2 weeks on our own time. We got Army Reserve pay for that. I don't remember how much that was, but we thought it was pretty good at that time until we got notice that we were activated. We were on active duty. We weren't exactly anticipating that.
Otherwise, it was just pin money coming
That's
in.
That's right. That's what it amounted to.
We forget how, I think most civilians forget how important mail is to the men in the services.
Oh, certainly. We were very, very popular people when the mail call came. Mm-hmm. They certainly were congregating around at the post office to get their mail. And of course, it was much more important than that when it was overseas.
Mm-hmm.
It was an interesting experience down there. We had, we went on what was called maneuvers at different times in the Fort Bragg area. We were simulating combat conditions, and so we operated little post offices in the field.
You went right with the mail?
Oh, yes, yes. And that was interesting.
How did you get the mail?
Well, we had vehicles and we had trucks, and we would drive back and forth.
From
the post office to wherever the location of the maneuvers was.
Mm-hmm.
And it was it was an interesting experience, and we had a lot of fun doing it.
Another point that I was thinking as you were giving us this view of your career was the buildings, the old building and
mm-hmm.
the new building.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, there were many attractive features about the old building.
Yes.
In a certain way.
Yes. But of course, we had outgrown it. Decatur had outgrown it. And the main reason, I'm sure, well, it had nothing to do with it, of course, but the main reason, I'm sure, was space. I mean, it just had been outgrown, and they needed a bigger, larger building.
Mm-hmm.
And even then, in 1935, the changes were significant as to the kind of post offices being built today. As they say, they don't make them like that anymore. If you people remember or take the time to come through the lobby of our current post office here, they'll find marble walls, terrazzo floor. We have a set of beautiful murals that were painted by some very top-flight artists depicting the history, the background of Central Illinois, including Lincoln. And these are registered in the National Historic Society archives. So I'm sure that nobody would dare paint over those murals in the post office.
Did they come from the old building, or
no,
were they built?
No, they were painted right on
mm-hmm.
on the walls in the new building. So it's a beautiful building on the inside. Again, we have outgrown it
mm-hmm.
because Decatur is mushroomed since 1935. So we for that reason, we have an annex over on Saragorda Street, the 400 block, and of course we had to build the Brentwood Station. So that alone tells that we have outgrown it, and I'm sure that eventually there will have to be some expansion done in order to provide services for Decatur.
And they tore down the old building?
Yes, it was torn down.
Now, I imagine in today's climate of historical preservation, that might have been saved.
I think maybe it might have been saved, because it was one of those old, ornate, Carnegie-style buildings, just like the same style the library was built. And it was, exterior-wise, it was interesting and beautiful, really.
But not too practical.
But not practical, that's right. When we built the Brentwood Station, or had it built, and we dedicated that building out there, Senator Paul Douglas was there and came down to help in the dedication services. And at that time, we thought that building would be adequate for 50 years, but we are rapidly outgrowing that too, because as you know, Decatur has expanded toward the north, and so we're just a little bit tight in the Brentwood Station, and I'm sure that that will have to be expanded before too long.
Well, it certainly is a reflection of the growth of the city and the way things have changed.
Some interesting things that have happened in the post office since over the last 50 years that I know about, and I think a lot of people don't realize what goes on behind the scenes, perhaps. Distribution clerk, you know, what's that? Well, the first thing you have to do in order to even keep the job as a distribution clerk, and that's true to this day, you are required to memorize every street and every block of every street in the entire city and know which carrier carries that area, because of course the city is divided up among the different carriers, and so they carry a certain area. Well, the distribution clerk has to know what streets are in that area and what carrier gets it, so that they can step up before a distribution case and rapidly distribute the mail. And some of them can do it very rapidly. Our production indicator has been excellent in that way. So that's the first thing you have to do, is memorize all of that thing, and it looks impossible to begin with, but it isn't.
That's one way in which a machine can't take the place of a man.
Eventually it will. And we get into the zip codes, which people sometimes have made fun of, but they were absolutely essential. Of course, you know, we have the 5-digit zip code now. Okay, that got it so that it was possible to electronically and mechanically sort mail down to a city, and sometimes even a section of a city. That's the reason that we, Decatur, is a multi-zip code city. In other words, we get mail in, broken down. All of this tray is for zip code 62521, or this one 22, and so forth, which helps us. Now, the zip plus 4 is coming in, adding 4 more digits. That will make it possible to electronically and mechanically sort mail down to what we call a block face. In other words, one side of one street in one block, or even a major building in that block, so that it comes in automatically, hey, this is a mail for this business, and nobody has to touch it. That's what the zip, the 4-digit add-on is going to do. And with mail volume going up constantly every year, it is certainly essential that that happen. When I came in the post office, national mail volume nationally was probably less than 50 million pieces a year, which I can't even imagine that. But now it's more than doubled. We're up to 131 billion pieces last year. We will average through the Decatur Post Office in the neighborhood of 225 to 230,000 pieces every day coming in, which have to be distributed and delivered. So there's a lot goes on behind the scenes that the general public sometimes don't realize.
I've sometimes wondered how these electronic devices find the zip code. I'm sure not everybody writes it legibly as
that's
possible.
True.
And the position on the envelope,
that's
but
true.
It just is able to locate a string of numbers.
Right, we call it address hygiene.
Mm-hmm.
And the zip code, particularly the four-digit add-on, zip plus four, is really designed for business. It is not, we don't concentrate too much on private individuals using the added four digits, but because business generates over 80% of our volume anyway, and business can, through their computers and their addressographs and whatnot, they can have address hygiene so that it is properly located and it's typed or printed, and the optical character readers, machines can easily sort it in that way. It's beyond comprehension how fast they can do that.
Well, there are many, many changes that have taken place in the Postal Service, some of these you've mentioned. Are there other changes that you've noticed especially?
Well, one of the major changes that took place, I can't remember exactly when, but it's been 25 or 30 years ago at least. We used to have two deliveries per day. The carriers came around twice a day, once in the morning, once in the afternoon. And I can remember carriers going out in the afternoon and the only mail they had would fit in one hand.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a total waste of time and money. So eventually the old post office department saw the light and thought, hey, let's eliminate that afternoon delivery, increase the length of the carrier's route, and thereby save some time and money. And so they did it. Well, people at first were critical. They wanted that second delivery, but 85 to 90% of the houses didn't get any mail in the afternoon anyway, so it didn't really make any difference. Another change that was made, which was certainly needed, I can remember at Christmas time, and again, this has got to be 25 or years ago at least, where it was almost like, well, the Christmas rush is coming, and it's panic time, because we will be inundated with mail. And we were, of course, still are. But at that time, well, we've got to hire a lot of extra people. So we would get students and citizens come in with applications, and we hired over 200 part-time workers for about 2 weeks during the Christmas rush to help us sort the mail and deliver the mail. Well, we finally realized that all we had to do with a little bit of change in management technique was use some overtime with our experienced people, and we could do the job faster and better and save all that time of hiring the extra people. So we started doing that, and it worked beautifully, and we've done it ever since.
You did something else, too. You put on a public relations campaign.
Exactly.
Mail early.
Yes, and that made a big difference. The public has certainly cooperated and become used to it now. It used to be that people didn't mail their Christmas cards until about 4 or 5 days before Christmas. But now, we start getting them right after Thanksgiving, and it's sort of leveled off thing, and it doesn't really bother us that much anymore. So we can easily handle the volume and deliver it. Oh, I can't remember when we didn't deliver every piece of mail that we got in every day.
And I'm sure that under the old system, a lot of mail people missed their own Christmas.
Oh, certainly. Yes, because we worked as much as 12 hours a day, you know, around the clock. People were in there working all the time. And you worked right up until the wee hours of Christmas morning,
mm-hmm,
to be sure that everything was out. So times have changed for the better in that way.
And it shows how problems can be solved.
Certainly, absolutely.
One big change, I'm sure, that has come about is the use of trains for postal service.
Yes, that was very prevalent when I first started, and of course for a number of years they were called railway post offices. And of course railway RPO clerks worked in the mail car on the train, and sometimes they didn't even stop at a little town. They just threw the pouch of mail off and picked up another pouch of outgoing mail from what they called a catcher arm on the side of the railroad track, and the train would come whizzing through there and they'd pick up this mail pouch with a catcher arm, and then the clerks on the inside of the train would have to brace themselves so that against the rocking of the train and to sort mail. Those went out as the trains dwindled. After that, we had for a while some highway post offices, which were just big buses, which did actually the same thing, with clerks on there distributing mail. And that finally went out as well. And a whole new system of transportation and delivery and sorting of mail came into effect with mechanization and so forth, and better management techniques.
And of course, there's been a change in airmail. For a long time, the public could buy airmail stamps for this service in this country.
Yes, yes. Well, the reason for that is that airmail, as such, became unnecessary, because that's the way ordinary mail travels anyway. So the only postage that's necessary, which is extra now, is our new class of mail, which is called express mail, which is the expedited overnight kind of mail. So that's one of the major changes that has been made. We've had plenty of competition, of course, and more competition comes along all the time. People ask about that, want to know, you know, why such and such a firm can provide service and so forth and take business away from the post office, or maybe in some cases do it cheaper. Well, it's relatively easy to explain, because the private segment or private company that goes into the mail business are certainly in it for one thing, and that's for profit. And therefore, in order to turn a profit, they have to take mail for a concentrated area where it's easy to deliver in bulk, very easy to do. And yes, they can do it cheaper and they can make money doing it. The post office is mandated, of course, by Congress to serve everybody in the country with mail delivery 6 days a week, no matter where they live, in Timbuktu or wherever, Alaska or Hawaii, whatever, in the most remote regions of the country, they are entitled to a mail delivery every day, 6 days a week. You can bet the private industry cannot afford to do that. So if the private express statutes, let's say, were repealed, and there's been some pressure to do that, that would be one of the major mistakes that our government ever made. Because what would happen is that the people who live in the remote regions of the country would get their postage rate raised 10 times or more, because the post office would be left with all of those hard-to-deliver places. Therefore, we would have to raise the postage rates sky high. And, of course, we would be blamed for it, but it wouldn't be our fault. So the private express statutes are essential, as the First Continental Congress that set them up said that they set up the Postal Service for the basic reason of communication to every single individual in the country, because it was the cord that ties the union together.
Part of democracy.
Exactly. So We get criticism for delays of mail once in a while, more than once in a while. But, you know, it always seems odd to me, and I've asked the question many times to people who complain to me about their service. How many times have you, when they say, well, I didn't get this letter and, you know, for 2 weeks, it was just mailed from Moroa. And I always ask them, well, how many times has this happened? Well, it happened once again last year. Well, how many letters have you received in the meantime? You know, and when you consider the number of pieces of mail you receive on time regularly compared to the number that you don't, it's pretty good service. People always remember the delays, but they can't seem to remember the huge volume of mail they get on time.
Okay. I'm sure you had many opportunities to move elsewhere, but you chose to stay in Decatur.
Mm-hmm.
Could you tell us why you chose this?
Well, I'm a native of Decatur. I was born and raised here. So my roots are in Decatur. I have a wide circle of friends in town. One of my daughters still lives here. I enjoy the people and became active in the community, and although some opportunities came along, I felt with the experience and the time I had put in to my present job that there were ample opportunities for advancement right here, that I didn't have to sell my home and buy another one and uproot the family and take them to some place which we might not enjoy as much as Decatur. In the first place, I have always felt that Decatur is a very progressive and a very excellent city to live in. The people are friendly, they're compassionate. I worked part-time at WSOY for about 30 years. And the way that came about was after I got out of the Army the second time with this postal unit that I mentioned, and came back into town and found that we weren't making that much money. And the budget was getting a little tight. You lose when you're in the service. I mean, you just the expenses don't balance. So I was looking for a part-time job, and a good friend of mine, who was state's attorney at that time, happened to mention, did you ever think of radio? Because he knew I had done quite a bit of public speaking and used to do some singing. And I said, no, I never thought of it. He said, well, I can't get you a job, but he says, I think I can get you an interview or an audition, which he did. And I went to work the next week part-time at WSOY and worked on weekends, Saturdays and Sundays, for almost 30 years. Did news, mostly music programs, and enjoyed it very much. It took up a lot of time, but my weekends were all filled, of course. So in effect, you're working 7 days a week. But it kind of gets in your blood. You enjoy doing it. It's fun. And I had some offers from other places in bigger markets to move into broadcasting full time. But I decided not to take advantage of that, because when you get into a top market, it doesn't make any difference how good you are. There's somebody else that's around that's just as good. And if you come up with a flu, you have to be off for a month or two, you might come back and find you don't have a job. So I decided to stay where the security was.
And use your broadcasting as a hobby.
As a hobby.
Avocation.
Certainly.
Didn't you do special programs at Christmas? I heard you do a program once at Christmas.
Yes, I used to do quite a few of those, and did some MC work around town for various organizations. It's just a very interesting hobby. I still do what we call production work, and that is work with the studios to produce commercials or things of that kind. So keep a foot in the door.
And you've never tried television?
Did try television. Of course, I do still do some of the voice on television. For a very brief period of time, I did newscast on television. And I've done some commercials on camera on television, too. But I enjoyed radio much better because you can concentrate on how you sound and what you're saying, and you don't have to worry about how you look. And that makes a difference.
Well, I'm sure you wouldn't have to worry about that anyway. Well, you really seem to have enjoyed retirement, or are enjoying it. You haven't had it very long.
Not very long, just since April the 30th. It's only been less than 2 months, but it's surprising how quickly you can get adjusted to that. There's plenty to do. I have no problem with that at all. I like community work. I like volunteer work, and do some of that, of course. Been active that way for a good number of years, and intend to stay that way because it's rewarding to do that kind of thing. I've been on with the United Way board for a number of years, and work on St. Mary's Advisory Board and things of that nature. That's, you meet such fine, dedicated people, and that's really one of the major joys in life, as far as I'm concerned, is associating with people and the accumulation of friendships. You can't beat that.
Well, it certainly has been a great benefit to Decatur that you have stayed with us, and that you have contributed to all this, not only through your work, but through your extracurricular activities, too. We certainly thank you for your reminiscences today, Mr. Miller, and we know that you will continue to give us the benefit of your time and talent, too.
I intend to do everything I can to promote Decatur and to enjoy the association of the people here.
Well, thank you very much. You have been listening to the reminiscences of Mr. Will Miller. This is Betty Trunell for the Decatur Public Library.